Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV
One. Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Coming up next on News One Now, President Donald Trump, is he endorsing police brutality? We'll talk about his remarks to New York cops and the pushback he has received from a number of police departments, plus the Congressional Black Caucus. And this morning, the Trump White House has a new chief of staff after the president dumped Reince Priebus and replaced him with John Kelly, the Secretary of Homeland Security. Can this shakeup somehow get this White House in order? I highly doubt it. A major partnership for Airbnb that will affect our communities, we'll discuss. Airbnb's Director of National Partnerships, Janae Ingram, will talk about her and the NAACP. And also, there's a revenue sharing program. Also, folks, we'll have a simulcast with the Tom Joyner Morning Show with a young man who spent 11 years in jail and never went to trial. How in the world does that happen? Plus, black women have to work 7 months more this year to make the same wages white men made in 2016. It doesn't matter whether they are doctors or cashiers. We'll discuss this as well. Plus, Fit Live Win Monday, and we'll discuss tips on transitioning from a healthy diet to a healthy lifestyle. It's time to bring the funk. News One Now on TV One. Donald Trump has never really gave a damn about victims of police brutality. In fact, you've never heard him speak out on the issue. All he often does is praise law enforcement for their actions. So it's no shock on Friday when he was in New York on Long Island and addressing gang violence, where he advised cops not to be too nice when it comes to handling criminal suspects.
And when you see these towns and when you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
Of course, you hear that applause, but there was a lot of negative response to Trump's remarks. It came fast and furious. The spokesman for the New York City Police Department said to suggest that police officers apply any standard in the use of force other than what is reasonable and necessary is irresponsible, unprofessional, and sends the wrong message to law enforcement as well as the public. The Congressional Black Caucus condemned Trump's remarks in a tweet saying, real Donald Trump, your racially coded call for police violence is shameful. We need hashtag a better deal on justice, not a worse one. But it may have been the spokesman for the Gainesville, Florida's police department who elicited the biggest response on social media about the comments. Officer Ben Tobias tweeted, quote, I'm a cop. I do not agree or condone POTUS remarks today on police brutality. Those that applauded and cheered should be ashamed. Also, the Suffolk County Police Department, where he was speaking, also condemned those comments. Joining us via Skype from Atlanta is Perry Tarrant. He's the assistant police chief in Seattle and the president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. Now, Perry, what was interesting here is that Trump makes this remark. And again, the point I made, he has never spoken out against police brutality. All you often see him do is praise law enforcement. Not a problem if folks are doing a good job, but when you have numerous examples of bad behavior by cops, you would think at some point he wouldn't joke about that matter.
Well, good morning, Roland, and good morning to your audience. I absolutely agree with you. I mean, he's been very clear from the very beginning that he is pro-law enforcement. However, I will absolutely tell you that it has been the entire history of NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, to promote professionalism. And I will tell you, of the 800,000 plus cops in the United States, that's the message they should be hearing, is professionalism. We're not thugs, we're professionals.
And to hear the folks in the audience laughing, first of all, we do not know if that audience necessarily was all police officers, so you can't ascertain, you know, who it was. But that's no joking matter.
It's absolutely no joking matter. Again, under the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, fair and equitable treatment for everybody. It doesn't say if they're suspected of being involved in a crime. So again, we're about professionalism. We're here in Atlanta this week with some 1,500 African-American law enforcement leaders promoting professionalism in policing.
And again, when you look at the New York City Police Department spending nearly $500 million in settlements, same thing in Chicago and other police departments, and when it comes to police brutality, you would think the President of the United States will learn that is no joking matter. That costs taxpayers.
Well, anytime anyone makes detracting comments about the professionalism of policing, it certainly sets us back. And more importantly, it certainly has an affront on the community.
All right, Perry, we surely appreciate it, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, have a good day.
Let's go to our panel here. Eugene Craig III, CEO of the Eugene Craig Organization, a Maryland Republican Party official, Lauren Victoria Burke, political analyst and writer for NBC Black, Linda McAllister, adjunct professor of history at La Roche College, also a Republican out of Pennsylvania. All right, folks, again, Lauren, you never hear the president say anything when it comes to police brutality, anything when it comes to police behavior. And so to joke this way, but the response from cops was pretty swift.
I was shocked by that, actually. I was shocked. I grew up in Suffolk County, Long Island, where that particular department made that statement. But typically what happens is everybody pretends that they didn't hear anything, and we go on to the next thing, and nobody says anything.
So like the Boy Scouts waiting 3 days
right,
issue
yeah.
an apology yeah. for Trump's speech to the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, exactly. So I was shocked that the Suffolk County police said anything. I thought they were just going to let the moment go by. And then there was another cop individually to put like a video yeah. out online, a retired sergeant. Okay. So that's like the first time that I can remember on the police brutality issue where you really got an affirmative response from law enforcement, even though some of it's been retired law enforcement, but something saying that this is not right.
Unfortunately, part of the reason why to that is, one, they don't want to be affiliated with these comments. Even if you looked at some of the people that were sitting behind the president, some of those folks looked uncomfortable. But let's not forget number two. We have had some police officers sitting right in their police vehicles, shot in the back of the head and killed. So when you start seeing people target police officers in Dallas, in New York City, and other places, and then you hear these comments, they're sitting there saying, listen, we're just trying to do our jobs and go home and be safe. They're realizing that they're putting a target on police officers' backs just as much as they may be putting targets on people that are accused of a crime. President Trump could care less about that, but these police officers understand that when you ratchet up this rhetoric, there may be a consequence for them as well.
The difference is this. When a police officer is killed, one in New York and the Dallas Five or whatnot, the entire country mourns for them. When we have a Philando Castile or a Freddie Gray that died from a rough ride being thrown in the back of a paddy wagon very roughly by the Baltimore City Police, the same Baltimore City Police that has now been found to plant drugs on people, half of America totally ignores it or discounts it.
No, more than half.
It's more than half.
Or makes excuses
for it. Or it becomes, oh my goodness, we're now guilty until proven innocent. We're now being treated the same way we treat people, the same way Donald Trump just asked police officers to treat criminals.
Right.
It
should be a higher standard.
It should be a higher standard.
It should be a crime that have yet to go to court. That's the difference. What
makes no sense here, too, is the president was there for MS-13. Anybody remember that? Of course not, because he's too busy running his mouth saying dumb things as usual with a bunch of cops, behind him, which makes no sense to me. And now basically the entire moment is lost on why he was there because he said something stupid.
Well, again, no, but it's no shock he said something stupid. and I'm sure this morning Ryan Priebus is happy. He defends stupidity from President Donald Trump. Priebus is no longer the chief of staff. In fact, when Trump got back from Long Island, he announced the firing of Ryan Priebus. Oh, I'm sorry. The moving on of Ryan Priebus.
Reince is a good man. John Kelly will do a fantastic job. General Kelly has been a star, done an incredible job thus far, respected by everybody. A great, great American. Reince Priebus, a good man.
How much of a good man? Well, guess what? After the announcement was made, two other staffers, senior staffers, were in the SUV with Priebus. When they saw those tweets, they got out of the car, and the Priebus SUV pulled out of the presidential motorcade. He couldn't even give the guy a ride back to the White House. Well, that's how he sort of treats his folks. Of course, he is blaming Priebus for the failure to get health care legislation. This has always, of course, been a marriage made in hell. He's being replaced by retired four-star general John Kelly, who was the Homeland Security Secretary.
Now, as far as John Kelly, he's going to be great. Keeping things organized, keeping everyone in their lane, controlling flow of information in and out of the Oval Office.
Well, let's see if that actually happens. He's supposed to bring some discipline to this administration. The one thing it does not have, good luck with that, John Kelly. Let's talk about this right now, of course, with Associated Press reporter. She, of course, has been covering the White House, Darlene Superville. Darlene, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. So if you're Rice Priebus this morning, you're probably saying, thank God I do not have to go into the White House. Look, this is the one job I don't think anybody wants, trying to wrangle this wild White House with Scary Mucci and Steve Bannon and all of these folks in the White House.
Well, Reince is going to be around for a couple of weeks. He's going to work on a transition with General Kelly. But the big question is whether or not General Kelly can actually bring discipline to the White House, as you mentioned in your opening. There are so many different people that can go straight to the president, and that was a problem that Mr. Priebus had in his role as chief of staff.
And then the most undisciplined person is the president.
That's the other factor in this equation. Will the president empower General Kelly to do the job that he needs to do in order to bring stability and structure to the White House operation?
He might be a four-star general, retired, and Trump supposedly respects the generals. But look, he didn't respect Mattis and others when it came to the transgender ruling. They had no idea it was coming down. I mean, you can see numerous examples. And let's talk about Kelly. When the initial Muslim travel ban came down, he had no idea. He heard about it getting a tweet or an email.
That's true. And at the time, remember, he was Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. So he wasn't actually physically in the White House where he could be involved in all the policy making and that kind of thing. Now he's actually going to be in the White House and can be. The hope is that he'll be able to assert some more control over the operation by physically being there.
This was a marriage made in hell, primarily because it was Priebus who called for Trump to drop out of the race after the comments came out. We talked about grabbing women by the vagina and also just doing whatever. And so Trump never really liked the guy.
Mr. Priebus had problems from the beginning, going back to that, suggesting that Donald Trump drop out of the race, the different people, the daughter, the son-in-law, all of those who have walk-in privileges to the Oval Office, they didn't have to report to Mr. Priebus. They could go straight to the father-in-law, the president, and do what they wanted. So the information, the people, it just never, all the lanes didn't flow to him. They flowed elsewhere. And now what seems to be the hope is that everyone will report to General Kelly. Scaramucci, who you just mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago, and he was hired, he made a point of saying that he reports directly to the president.
And reiterated that last week.
Yes, he's been saying that quite a bit. and so one thing that we're all going to be looking for is whether he will still continue to report to the president or whether General Kelly will be able to rein him in a little bit.
I think Kelly's going to last about 6 months himself.
That's about the over-under on
this. I don't think there's any way you can be a retired four-star general and you are used to order.
Right.
And the person who above you is totally chaotic.
And the other problem, too, is that Reince Priebus was a link to Congress, and they have nobody now. So now at least you had Reince talking to you can see the Republicans edging closer and edging closer and edging closer to criticizing this president. And this little episode with the Department of the Interior Secretary, where they threatened the two senators from Alaska, Dan Sullivan and Lisa Murkowski, that was one of the dumbest things they could have done. That filters down through all the members of the Senate on the Republican side. They don't get that.
But that's not who he's trying to talk to. He continues to not necessarily talk to Capitol Hill. He's still going out there. He went to Youngstown, Ohio. Who is he talking to? He's talking to people, same people that voted for him. What is he doing? He's still campaigning. So this guy's not really looking at focusing on policy and getting stuff done, because if he were, he would be making friends. Eugene. He would understand that there's got to be some people close to me that I got to get working with me on
something. The thing is this. The president owes his presidency to Reince Priebus. In those last 60 days, four folk, they got him elected. Reince Priebus, Sean Spicer, Kellyanne Conway, David Bassi. That's who he owes his presidency. I think Reince Priebus deserves a lot more respect than he got from this president as chief of staff. And let's see what happens.
But Darlene, we've seen this president has no sense of loyalty to anybody but himself and his family.
That's true.
Maybe not even.
So again, John Kelly, you're now in the sunken place. Now you are. Sean left. Priebus is out. Now you're there. Darlene, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, a man spent 11 years behind bars, no trial. He is now finally free. We will talk to his lawyer, Mississippi Judge Carlos Moore, who's representing Stephen Jesse Harris in this shocking case. That's next, News 1 Now on TV 1.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
All right, folks. All right, folks. TV 1, we're about to have our simulcast with the Tom Joyner Morning Show. So we will have them shortly. All right.
Roland Martin, good morning.
Tom, Sybil, Arsenio Hall, how we doing?
Dog, what's up, bro?
Great, great. Tom, you were in Cincinnati this weekend?
Man, I was there for the Cincinnati Music Festival. 44,000 people each night, three nights, in Paul Brown Stadium.
Wow. I didn't realize they even had one in Cincinnati. I got the
You know, most people don't know about the Cincinnati Music Festival. It's the Midwest version of the Essence Music Festival.
Now,
they draw more people. They draw more people to Cincinnati than Essence does to New Orleans.
Now, who do we miss?
They should hold it in Chicago. Everybody was from Chicago.
I know. Everybody. 60% of the audience was from Chicago. The rest of them were from Detroit and Cleveland and Dayton and Columbus. Only, 80% of the people there were from out of town.
I need to put that on my list then, especially when you describe that lineup. So I got to do that. Of course, I was in Atlanta this weekend for Hank Stewart's White Linen Affair. It was phenomenal. Angie Stone says hello, and Norman Brown and Tony Terry. Had a good time there. And, Tom, tomorrow, Louisville, Kentucky, the most worshipful Prince Hall Grand Lodge. I will be celebrating 150 years, and I'll be the keynote speaker tomorrow, so I'll be in Louisville, Kentucky. So looking forward to that. And so let's get right to today's business, Tom. This stunning story out of Mississippi. Black man freed after 11 years in jail without a trial. Stephen Jesse Harris had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was put in the Clay County, Mississippi jail, charged with the murder of his father, kidnapping a woman and shooting at officers in October of 2005. In April of 2008, doctors said he was incompetent to waive his constitutional rights or to stand trial. But it wasn't until last week that authorities dismissed all charges against Harris, citing his mental status. Judge Carlos Moore, of course, Tom, he is the judge who removed the Mississippi state flag because of that Confederate symbol from his courtroom on his first day. He's representing Harris. He's the managing partner of Tucker Moore Group. Judge, the man spent 11 years in jail, no trial. Did anybody, any prosecutor, did anybody say this is wrong?
No, Roland. Unfortunately, no one said it was wrong. The prosecutor was a longtime prosecutor that had been in office for 30 years, and he was known to do things on the fringes. And so he let the man sit in jail for 11 years with no trial. Luckily, a black prosecutor was historically elected in that district, and he did the right thing and sought justice and moved to non-pros and allow the man out.
Well, first of all, let's give that brother, that black prosecutor credit. What's that prosecutor's name?
Scott Colomb, a young brother in his early 30s that got won the election and did the right thing.
So another example of what happens when blacks become prosecutors, they are fair and just, and of course, and they live by that creed on the wall of the Supreme Court, equal justice under law.
Correct.
So your client, what did you say to him when he discovered that he was no longer going to have to be in jail?
His brother, his twin brother, hired me because, of course, my client is schizophrenic. He doesn't exactly know what's going on, but his brother was elated. His brother is a paralegal student now, and he's studying law because of this ordeal, and he was very much elated. He was in tears to know that his brother was finally coming home and that the nightmare was finally over.
When you say coming home, though, isn't he also still, though, in a facility because of his schizophrenia?
He is, but he will be released at some point to his brother's care. His brother has taken it upon himself to make sure he gets his meds and things. And should he be functional in society, he will continue to remain with his brother. However, if things get too rough, he may have to have him institutionalized again in some type of home where he can get further specialized treatment.
We know about the yes, Tom, go ahead.
Was he charged with it again?
He was charged with murdering his father and, Judge, correct me if I'm wrong, kidnapping another woman?
Correct, as well as shooting at three police officers.
And 3 years after it happened, that's when he was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
3 years after it happened was when he was diagnosed, evaluated by a mental health professional, and he was ruled not competent to stand trial. We believe he was already schizophrenic, but the courts have different standards, and so they had him examined to see if he was competent to stand trial, and that psychiatrist said no.
He had been in jail that period of time? He had been in prison that period of time when he was examined?
So even though he was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 2008, that means he spent 9 more years in jail?
That's correct. 9 more years. And had not Scott Colomb won the historic election, he would likely still be sitting in jail.
So no one, there was no judge, there was no DA, there was no one who said, yo, we got a problem.
No one. He was blessed to have the twin brother. The twin brother had been away for a while. He came back home to Mississippi last year, and that's when he hired me to look into the situation, and we got involved, and we began to seek justice, and we talked to the prosecutor, and he chose to do the right thing.
This reminds me of the Khalif Browder case in New York. The young black man spent 3 years in Rikers Island for allegedly stealing a backpack, was eventually released, but the brother committed suicide because of the trauma that he had to endure.
Correct. And this man, he has withstood things unimaginable. I can't imagine one of my loved ones sitting in jail for 11 years without benefit of a trial. No matter what they're accused of, we are presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. So Mississippi is going to have to pay for this heinous act. Another injustice yet again.
Has the governor or anybody issued an apology to this family?
Not at all. So a federal lawsuit will be filed soon.
Who will bear the greater responsibility? I know you said there's going to be money, but who really says, or who do you point the finger at and say, this is your fault? Is it just the system?
It's the system, but it's Clay County. Clay County is the county that had him locked up, so they will be named as defendant. The sheriff will be named. We will look at the prosecutor. The prosecutor and judge usually have immunity, so it's really going to be the sheriff and the county.
Now, let me be clear here. He's still going to trial for murder, right?
The charges have been dropped. As of last week, he would not stand trial for murder. The charges have been dropped. You have a right to a speedy trial, so surely 11 years is not a speedy trial.
Well, and again, he was declared incompetent, so therefore that's why he didn't stand trial. And to your point, if they decide to retry, if they decide to retry him, first of all, can they do that now the charge has been dismissed? Explain that legal status.
The charges have been dismissed without prejudice. Should at some point in the future two psychiatrists agree that he is now competent or is then competent to stand trial, the prosecutor could reinstitute the charges, but it's not likely. That's in theory. It could happen, but it's not likely.
Is he the only person that's in prison for the same sort of thing? There are others. I'm just guessing that you know.
None to my knowledge in Mississippi. I hear that's something similar in Alabama.
Right. There is a case in Alabama that we're going to be following up on as well. I talked to somebody at the NAACP convention last week in Baltimore, and we'll be following that story as well. But Judge Moore, thank you very much for your leadership as well. Again, it's just shameful. 11 years in prison, never went to trial. Judge Carlos Moore, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Roland.
To be black in America, Tom.
You know it.
Wow.
What have we got to lose?
Hey, thank you, Roland. Thanks for bringing that, man.
Now, Prel Marcinio, thanks a lot.
26 past. the hour.
All right, folks, next on News One Now, Airbnb is partnering with the NAACP. We will talk about that next. Also on today's show, it is Black Women's Equal Pay Day. Why do Black women have to work extra months every year to be paid the same as white men? And how could that be fixed? We'll look at a new study that examines that. All that next, News One Now on TV One.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
The NAACP is the country's oldest civil rights organization, and Airbnb, the world's leading hospitality company, are teaming up to spread the economic benefits of home sharing and touring to communities of color. The partnership will focus on a series of commitments: community outreach and education, revenue sharing, a diverse employee base, and supplier diversity. The partnership comes amid accusations of discrimination against minorities by Airbnb hosts that include guests being denied accommodations because they are Black. The interim president and CEO of the NAACP, Derek Johnson, said, quote, "This is groundbreaking partnership with Airbnb will help bring new jobs and economic opportunities to our communities. Airbnb's commitment to that goal is a tremendous step in the right direction for Silicon Valley to open its doors to African Americans and other communities." Joining us is Director of National Partnerships for Airbnb, Janae Ingram. Of course, our panel is still with us as well. So, Janae, when this report was done, we had the woman who did the report, Eric Holder, also. Mm-hmm. Of course, his expertise was used. And so has there been any other partnership like this in terms of an actual revenue share?
No, this is the first time that we have ever done a revenue sharing agreement. And it seemed like the NAACP would be a great partner to do that. Obviously, they are the longest and oldest civil rights organization in the country. They have branches in pretty much every city, state chapters and affiliations in every state. And so, and NAACP was the group that we felt like we could do this with.
And how will this revenue sharing work? How will the partnership work?
So some of the deals of the partnership are still being worked out. We have to still do a little bit of meeting with the NAACP to figure out how it will work on the ground. But we're in the process of identifying five cities that we will sort of target for this program. And basically what will happen is we'll do a series of outreach and educational events, which you mentioned, targeting communities of color to talk about Airbnb and the economic opportunity that exists. I think there's a lot of people who don't necessarily understand that. How hosting can be another way to earn extra income that can either help you stay in your home, mm-hmm. pay your bills, things of that nature. And so we want to really have these conversations with communities of color and let them know that this is an option for them.
Now is revenue sharing with those select cities?
Yes.
Okay.
So it will be with whatever cities we decide on, mutually agree on. It will be in those cities where NAACP helps us identify a new hosts that they will see a percentage, 20% of what we earn from those hosts.
So what's the cap on cities? Just five?
It's five cities. We're starting out at five. We anticipate that this will be a longer-term partnership, but we're starting out with five cities that we agree on and starting there.
So it won't be existing Airbnb customers. It will actually be any new customers.
Yes.
Now, any new customers driven by the NAACP or just any new customers who sign up after a particular date in those cities?
I think it most likely will be any new customers that sign up in the city.
Well, let me ask this question. One of the concerns I have is, when does this move from being reactionary to proactive? It seems as though this is a reactionary move based on some bad press. When is it moved to being more of a proactive move where African Americans can see more opportunity behind the keyboard when it comes to programming, when it comes to their product management as well as program management? What's the next phase of this so that it's not just something that's going to gloss over the PR nightmare that this has been for Airbnb and something that will truly build jobs and build careers for African Americans?
Well, I appreciate your question, and I'm here to tell you this is not something that is reactionary. This is something that it has been happening for quite a bit of time. Just because we're now coming out with the announcement, I understand why people would say, oh my gosh, this is them just trying to cover up the work that they've done. I've been on this show numerous times, not in a role as from Airbnb. I've been an activist, I've been fighting and an advocate for the community. And the thing that drew me to Airbnb was a surprise to me. I probably was a little skeptical as well. Upon learning about the company and talking to people inside of the company, what I can say is the company is very genuine in their desire to not be a place where discrimination happens. The mission for Airbnb is to create a world where anyone can belong anywhere. And so in that comes the opportunity for people to host on the site, comes the prevention of discrimination. And lots of efforts have been made over the past year to work on that. This is another step in that direction. To your point about creating more opportunity, that's part of the NAACP agreement as well, that they will help us with recruiting and supplier diversity, things that the company has outlined is a priority for them. In every meeting that we have with our CEO, he outlines that diversity and ensuring that everyone can have a seat at the table is a priority, and it's something that's consistent.
Do we know what the NBC Black piece referenced a hiring goal?
Yes.
So do we know what the numbers are for African Americans at Airbnb right now in terms of who's employed at Airbnb?
I don't know those numbers right offhand, but there is a report that people can find online that has those numbers. I believe in terms of African Americans, we're somewhere between 2 and 2.5%.
Mm-hmm. Typical in Silicon Valley. You know, is there a goal that you guys are trying to hit along with the help of the NAACP, or is there?
There's a general goal. So there's a general diversity goal of 11% by the end of 2017.
Okay.
That goal has been publicly stated, and we are working toward that every day. The company has. One of the things that the company has done over the past year is instituted sort of the Rooney Rule, which basically says that you have to have a diverse slate of candidates that come in for one of the final sets of interviews, the in-person interviews. And so that's another thing that we've done to ensure that there's diversity.
Okay. Quick question.
I'm loving the new product, the model that you guys are putting forth there. Have other companies or senior diversity officers reached out to you about what you guys are doing, and the potential of maybe copying the model and applying it to their company?
I don't know if no one has reached out to me specifically. I have heard, however, that in some Silicon Valley meetings, people have referenced, how can we do what Airbnb is doing? And by no means does that mean that we think that we are the model. We still have a lot of work to do, and that's what this partnership will help us sort of move toward.
All right, then, Jenny, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we come back. Gender wage gaps have improved over the past 37 years, but racial wage gaps are getting worse. A new study finds that Black women's wages were just 67% of white men's last year. We will discuss that next. Also, Fit Live Win Monday, we break down steps for you to live a healthier lifestyle. Plus, we'll have our hashtag HBCU Giving Day College. All of that. Next, News One Now on TV One.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Today is Black Women's Equal Pay Day. It's the day that marks how long in 2017 an African-American woman has had to work to be paid the same as her white male counterpart last year. According to the Economic Policy Institute for African-American Women, have to work 7 months into 2017 to make the same amount of money white men made in all of 2016. That is true whether the woman is a physician, an accountant, or working behind the register at a retail store. Even Black women with an advanced degree earn just over $7 an hour less than white men who have only a bachelor's degree. A study finds the gap has gotten worse over time. In 1979, Black women were near wage parity with white women, but in 2016, white women's wages grew to 76% of white men's wages. Black women are still at 67% of that. Joining us now is Joy Cheney, the executive director and campaign manager for Equal Pay Today. And our panel, of course, Eugene Craig, Lauren Victoria Burke, and Lenny McAllister. Now, critics will say, well, it's unfair to do this overall comparison because there's just so many other different factors that could come into play.
There are certainly lots of factors that contribute to the wage gap. That said, we know that when you account for all of those factors, there's still a gap between women and men, and that a lot of that gap is unexplained, and it can't be made up for by women's choices or men's choices or all of the other things that they say are our faults, right? So there's something in there that's unexplained. It's a great deal of the gap, and so we are talking about it, and that's why we're focused on the wage gap.
And what sectors are the most egregious in terms of separation with wages?
Well, to be honest with you, the wage gap persists across occupations. So it exists in the news occupation, it exists in the legal occupation, it exists, as your opening showed, as well as retail occupation. So it's not, I don't think, so much fair to say one area is worse than the other. One of the things we do know is that when a woman or a man is unionized, the wage gap is smaller.
Right. Joy, does this also apply to opportunity gap? For example, if you have two physicians and a white male is offered an opportunity to join three boards, which is going to augment his income, versus that African-American doctor, woman that is not allowed to join those boards or not offered to join those boards, is that taken into consideration? Because the opportunity gap has to be part of that wage gap as well, I'd have to imagine.
Absolutely. So when we talk about these numbers, we're talking about full-time working women working all year, okay? But you're absolutely right. My mother is a physician in Orlando, Florida, and when she began her pediatric practice in the 70s, she could not get a loan. The Latino doctor, also in Orlando, who was a pediatrician, also could not get a loan. What that meant is they had to work much harder to have the basic medical things that you need to set up a medical practice. They had to earn that money before they could actually purchase. They had to purchase things on credit. It took a lot longer for them to catch up with some of their white male colleagues who were able to get business loans. So you're absolutely right. There was an opportunity gap there.
You said something about unions and fixed wages. Yeah. Isn't one of the escape routes to this is to get involved in employment where you're getting paid the same? Everyone is getting paid the same. Like, say, if you're a photographer for Associated Press and the day rate is $4.25, it's $4.25 for everybody.
Yeah. Of course, the thing is, you have to get the job.
Right.
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 And once you get the job, you actually have to be given the hours. So with union workers, what wage gap looks like for them is, are they getting the hours? Are they getting the opportunities?
Right. Uh-huh.
Once they get in them, they may be paid the same, but if you don't get them, then
right
there you have it.
Now, if you're a dentist, a filling is a filling, right?
If you're a dentist, a filling is, you know, a filling, mm-hmm. but for instance, there may be other opportunity gaps that we discussed earlier. And frankly, not everyone works for themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you may be working for a hospital, a school, or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of gains have you guys been seeing? Have you ever seen any gains, any clothing?
So there's been lots of gains. So I'm so glad you asked. Around the country, I don't know if you're aware of these prior salary bans that have been sprouting up across the nation, and the chamber and others have taken notice because it started in Massachusetts. There was a lot of business support for them, and they are bans on the use of prior salary. We've all gone for a job, and what's the first thing they ask you? What did you make at your last job? Mm-hmm. Well, that really is a custom, but there's no relationship with how well you do on the job. When they ask that, though, it allows the wage gap to perpetuate itself. And it's not just because of discrimination. It may be a problem. It may be a problem because you are a person trying to recover from economic downturn.
Right.
It could be any number of reasons. There's no reason to carry an artificially low salary with you from job to job.
Have you ever studied public salaries that are public? I mean, like, if you studied all the salaries on Capitol Hill, you can see what everybody makes. Have you ever looked
there
at that? Yeah. Have you ever taken a look at that?
So there's a wage gap everywhere.
Uh-huh.
We'll leave it there. And members of Congress aren't always held to the same laws and standards as the other employers around the nation, but there's certainly a wage gap there. And that's so funny that you should mention that, because Congress has a real opportunity to do something to really show that they support the wage gap, and that is to protect EEOC's pay data collection. So, Roland, everyone here knows, in the Obama administration, President Obama made pay equity a chief part of his priority. I was at EEOC. It was one of our priorities. What we've seen in the first 6 months now of the Trump administration is a real rollback on that. And what we're seeing now is a threat to the pay data collection on race, gender, and ethnicity to really show the intersection on black women, black men, and others of what the pay gap looks like.
Who did you count among black people? Because he's only got three, four on that list that they put out, it was like four.
I'm not here.
Can I ask real quick, have you gone to cities and told them, if you close this, you'll be able to bolster your city's overall? Cities such as my hometown of Pittsburgh, they're trying to attract more minorities, more women in positions of power. Have you been able to go to some of these cities and say, if you're trying to make your civic society stronger and better, you need to close this and this is how?
Equal Pay Today is a national campaign, and we have state projects, women's law projects all over the country, and including Women's Law Project in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So we have been going to cities and states all over the country and really talking to them about closing the wage gap. It would cut poverty in half.
Yeah.
All right, then. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Go out and tweet 2 to 3 today. Black women's equal pay.
All right, then. Also, where can people actually see the study? Where can they go? What's the site?
Go to www.blackwomen'sequalpayday.org.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, y'all, coming up next on Fit, Live, Win, how can you transition to a healthy diet into a healthy lifestyle, Eugene? That's next. Also, we'll give you our hashtag HBCU Giving Day University. I'm wearing the lapel pin of Wilberforce University. So we'll have the address for you as well. All right, y'all, it is 12:04, top of the hour, News 1 Now on TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
As I said before the break, folks, you know, we have our initiative HBCU Giving Day. On Thursday, I was in Philadelphia speaking to the National Alumni Conference of Wilberforce University. And so that's one of the reasons why I am rocking their lapel pin, as you can see right here. They chose not to go small. Wilberforce, of course, established in 1856. It was the first college to be owned and operated by African Americans. And so they have a new president there. We spent some time last week. Also, he has an engaged board. So, yeah, that's a lapel pin right there. Felton is their president. We had a good time with the alumni. Again, pull the graphic up, please, again. So Wilberforce University's HBCU Giving Day. Go to their site, giving.wilberforce.edu. And we had a great conversation talking about their entrepreneurship center there. That was one of the things that we discussed. They also turn out a significant number of biology graduates. And as I said, to any university as a part of this initiative, we don't care if you give $100, $75, $50, $25, $10, $5, $1, you should simply give. Now, again, we select a university each and every single day. It could be another university that you want to give to. That's fine, because this is the point that we keep making. We can't keep talking about black institutions if we don't fund those institutions. We can't talk about black banks. We can't talk about black colleges. We can't talk about black media if we don't fund them. And so if you're a Wilberforce graduate and you have not given any money, you should. Because don't walk around claiming your letters and claiming your college and you don't send any money back. And so, again, and according to the president, when we talked, he said that when he got there, 1% of Wilberforce graduates were giving back to the university. That number now, 2 years later, is now 9%. But still, it should be a hell of a lot higher. So, HBCU, hashtag HBCU Giving Day, University is Wilberforce University. Of course, folks, every Monday, of course, we have our Fit, Live, Win segment, trying to keep you healthy and fit. You may have seen my next guest on the documentary, What the Health, which is setting the streaming world on fire. A good portion of the film focuses on transitioning from a healthy diet to a healthy lifestyle. Well, holistic health and wellness expert Dr. Ruby Lathan joins us to give us some tips on how to transition to a healthier lifestyle. Now, what does that even mean? What does that mean? Okay, so transitioning to a healthy lifestyle.
That means, you know, there's when you're switching, when calling a vegan diet, a lot of people don't know what that means, but it encompasses your food, encompasses basically trying to do anything that keeps away from animal cruelty or using any animal products at all. So clothing, environmental issues, as well as food. And it's healthier based on the science. Most people, you know, have less disease, less obesity, and all the other maladies that kind of plague us today.
All right. And so when you say moving to that,
yes.
Okay, what's that process?
Well, I always say first you've got to find recipes, because that's the first thing. You've got to plan ahead. So a lot of people who maybe transition to plant-based diets might do it and not really have a plan, and then they're just caught out there and they kind of slip back. So you have to plan ahead, know what you're going to eat, know where you can find good food, so that you know what's on the agenda for the day.
Okay, and so how have you done it?
Have I?
Yeah, now you on the spot.
Well, you know, Roland, I had a health issue. I had cancer, and I switched quite quickly because I wanted to heal that naturally. And so that's why I switched to a plant-based diet. So for me, it was like, I'm going to do this to get well. So it was a little bit easier because I had a big motivation to do it. But I followed a lot of the same things I'm saying. I started looking for recipes. I had to learn how to cook again in a healthy way, using foods that would heal my body. So that's what I do now, teach people how to cook in a different way that's healthy, but using foods that taste good and nourish the body at the same time.
Talk about the role of just going back to the basics. Grab an apple, grab a banana, grab some fruit, and fill part of your day up with that. We forget about that so often because we're on the go. Can you talk about, hey, there's things right in front of you, and you don't have to make this too complicated?
That's right. What I often tell people is a lot of times you can cook entrees on the weekend and then just fill in the gaps with salads and the fruits you're talking about, trail mix, air popped corn, things that don't make it complicated, you know, and you can take with you. Always keep those snacks in your desk. That way you're getting your fruit in that has all the antioxidants that you need, as opposed to going to the vending machine for the 2 p.m. crash, right? So absolutely stocking up on healthy foods, healthy nut and fruit bars, things like that. I always keep one in my purse, so I'm never going to, you know, be caught out there starving.
Well, what are some of your favorite tools? I know some of the favorite apps that you think will help folks transition to this vegan diet.
Absolutely. Well, I like one of the apps is Happy Cow that I use. It gives you like a list.
Happy
of,
cow?
Yes.
What the hell is a happy cow?
It means a cow that's not going to be eaten is a happy cow.
Ones that work for Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, and so it lets you know restaurants that are a vegetarian and vegan friendly that you can go to. Of course, I like my own website because I have recipes and videos for people to help. So I usually scout out, like if I'm going out of town, where are some good plant-based options that I'm going to make a stop at. Okay.
So there's no meat. You don't do any meat whatsoever.
I don't miss it. Initially, I thought, you know, this is going to be deprivation, especially going completely plant-based, no mac and cheese, no potato salad, no this, that, and the other. Right. But I learned how to make the alternatives.
You do none of that?
I do all of that. I thought I couldn't because those have dairy products and things in it, but I learned how to make it without it. And so there's no deprivation, and they taste better to me, and they're healthy, so I don't have to feel guilty about eating that kind of food.
So you try and tip me when that was a barbecue.
My barbecues are good.
What's at your barbecue? What's at your barbecue?
I like to make the buffalo cauliflower wings is one with the dipping sauce.
What'd you just say?
So instead of chicken wings, we have buffalo's cauliflower, and you know, you have the little heads of cauliflower and make it in a buffalo sauce, and it is incredible. Everybody, you will not miss the chicken. I can bring some next time I come.
No, I'm good. What else is at your barbecue?
Like veggie kebabs, I'm going to grill on the grill. There's baked beans, of course. There's obviously the potato salad. There's going to be always some kale salad, right? But there's going to be veggie burgers. There's going to be there's going to be hot dogs, veggie hot
y'all
dogs.
Y'all think I'm going there because I'm leaving.
You will feel
Did
good.
You just say cauliflower wings?
Yes, you have got to try it. The recipe it. Is
there are veggie
on my
hot
site.
Dogs out there. Heard
that are
good.
Really good.
Not that I've tried them, but I've heard they're very good.
You got to try it.
That's good.
The key is giving yourself trying a lot of different ones because you might not like some.
Cauliflower wings.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a new one.
Good stuff.
You know what?
Everybody loves it.
I think Ruby should come back and we should all try it.
I agree. I would love to cook up something for you guys.
I'm interested.
Labor Day cookout.
They're going to try it.
And it keeps you feeling good and light on your feet, because I know you like to dance. And so this will keep you.
I can dance without eating ribs. I'm good.
This will keep you even lighter on your feet.
I'm good. I'm good. I don't know about the cauliflower wings, though.
We're going to try these cauliflower wings.
You got to try
it. We can try it together.
Absolutely.
I'm going to try one. You try one.
You will love it.
You better slap some sweet.
You better slap some sauce
on them.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's all in the sauce and the seasoning. That's what makes food taste good. So you just got to marinate, season, bake, all the good stuff. That's the key. That really is the key. Look, I grew up in Alabama, so I know what good food tastes like. You know, we're you know, kings and queens of barbecue down there. So
no, hold up, stop. Ain't no kings and queens of barbecue in Alabama. They don't make the top five list. I love Alabama, but y'all ain't the kings and queens of barbecue. Y'all know that. Girl, you need to go ahead and stop. Let me go to a break. Back in 60 seconds, News 1, not TV 1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
Birthday shout out, Tennessee Titans. Brian Arapco turns 31. Former NFL player DeMarcus Ware turns 35. Great Denver Bronco. Actor Wesley Snipes turns 55. And former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, turns 61. I'll see you guys tomorrow right here on News 1 Now on TV 1. Don't forget Wilberforce University. I got to go. Hi!
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now. With Roland Martin.